From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we examine what barriers to abortion still exist in Wisconsin amidst the coronavirus, despite telehealth being encouraged in healthcare. Then we hear about several instances of journalists being injured or arrested at protests across the country.
It makes me wonder what sort of training that some of these officers are getting with regard to treatment of the press. But yeah, the kinds of things that I'm seeing right now are really unfortunate and clear violations of the law.
Plus, RuPaul's Drag Race winner and Milwaukee native Jada Essence Hall talks about the city's drag community and working through the pandemic.
Drag queens are fighters, and we usually are used to working in sometimes in terrible predicaments and situations, but we always turn it and make a way, and this pandemic has been no different.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin is known for having some of the most restrictive abortion laws in the nation. Currently, only 3 clinics in the state provide abortion services. If women are able to get appointments, additional restrictions such as no Medicaid coverage, state-directed counseling, and a 24-hour waiting period require multiple trips. While this can already be a significant barrier for some women, now the coronavirus pandemic also presents other challenges. Telemedicine has been widely encouraged and used during the pandemic to reduce the spread of COVID-19. But despite its use being approved at many medical facilities, the same has not applied for abortion clinics. There is an argument to lift the current ban on telemedicine for abortion care. Barbara Alvarez, a UW-Madison PhD student studying information access and abortion, says services like medicated abortion and informed consent can easily be done over the phone or online, eliminating unnecessary multiple trips to a clinic. To find out more, I'm joined by Alvarez and Dr. Jenny Higgins, UW-Madison professor in obstetrics and gynecology and gender and women's studies. Dr. Higgins begins by explaining what paved the way for a number of restrictions that were imposed on abortion access for women in Wisconsin.
With the change in the shape of our legislature in the 2010 election, right? So where both the governorship and the state and the Senate and House changed, right, from Democratic to Republican, that paved the way for a number of restrictions that were proposed and implemented between, say, 2011 and 2013. Those restrictions were numerous and multifaceted in terms of their attempts to, and successful attempts to restrict abortion access. So for example, we have a ban against telemedicine for abortion care or medication abortion, which is a pill that can be discussed remotely and then taken by the patient in her own home. In many other states, telemedicine is common practice across a variety of health situations, including medication abortion, but that is outlawed here in our state. Even though the use of telemedicine is widely practiced in our state for other kinds of procedures, as we're seeing here in Wisconsin during COVID right now, and even though telemedicine for medication abortion services is the widespread recommendation from all major professional organizations in our country. Another type of restriction we face in our state is a 24-hour mandatory waiting period. So a patient will has to go physically to a healthcare center, receive mandatory counseling that contains some non-factual information, and she has to pay for that visit, even though she receives no medical care. She then has to wait at least 24 hours before reporting back to the clinic to receive either her medication abortion pills or her in-clinic surgical abortion. That restriction places huge demand on patients who have to travel large distances to get to those facilities. It's difficult to take 2 or more days off from work to find childcare and other things. A restriction in our state that's been on the books for a long time, but deserves mention, is that we are prohibited from using Medicaid insurance to cover abortion costs in our state and elsewhere. Barbara, I'd love to hear if you'd have other restrictions or limitations you might add.
No, I think those are good. You mentioned something about how telehealth is being used widely in our state for all other types of health services. And it's interesting because on April 2nd, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services put out a release encouraging patients and providers to provide telehealth services during COVID-19. But as Dr. Higgins said, that doesn't include abortion. So even though telehealth is being used and is being recommended during COVID-19, abortion is exempt from that.
Now, with this release, was abortion services exempt strictly in written form, or was it just excluded, leaving clinics unsure of where their place is during, especially during COVID-19, where a lot of medical places have had to adjust their protocols and the way they service patients?
Do you know the answer to that, Barbara? I'm not sure.
You know, when I looked at the release, it didn't say anything about abortion in the release. I can't speak to what confusion that may or may not have caused. I will say, though, that in the release, it included that the Division of Quality Assurance had made it possible for healthcare providers to no longer need a separate certification to provide these types of services. So again, it didn't say anything about abortion, but it does show that there have been dramatic steps have been taken to provide telehealth services and other health services.
Right. And that's important because Planned Parenthood, of course, offers many medical services outside of abortion. So when it comes to Planned Parenthood's strategy and response, how has COVID-19 changed what services these clinics can offer throughout their whole spectrum of what they do for patients?
Well, so it's interesting because if you go to the Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin website, any of the clinics, there's three of them, Sheboygan, Milwaukee, and Madison. There are telehealth options for every single service, including STD screening, annual examination. The one exemption is abortion. So Planned Parenthood has really stepped up and is providing these telehealth services where they're able to do so, but the law doesn't allow them to do it via abortion. The other thing is in Illinois, there are typically about 9 Planned Parenthood clinics in the Chicago area, like in the city of Chicago and in the surrounding area of Chicago. Right now, the Planned Parenthood clinics in Illinois have consolidated to just 6 clinics. That means that of those 9 from Chicago, now there's only 2. So there's only 6 clinics in the entire state. And that's significant to women in Wisconsin because, as Dr. Higgins explained, there are so many barriers, as it is in Wisconsin, to receive abortion that many people seeking abortion go out of state, and Illinois is a natural location. And so because those services are being consolidated in Illinois, that's also going to impact people who are coming out of state.
As you know, the Wisconsin Supreme Court overturned Governor Evers' stay-at-home order. Does that further complicate what policies are established at these medical clinics?
It's a great question, and things are changing every day, right? So we're following along with you. We do know that early on in COVID, legislators in Wisconsin were leveraging COVID as a way of saying abortion and contraception aren't essential services, even though we know that abortion and contraception are time-sensitive essential services that people need in order to prevent and terminate unwanted pregnancies. The ways in which COVID has shaped patient care has affected abortion healthcare facilities, just like all other healthcare facilities. And clinics have really had to strike the balance between protecting staff and patients, that's of utmost concern, while also trying to meet patient demand and the need for services at this time. I wanted to go back a moment when we were talking at the beginning about what types of restrictions exist in Wisconsin. Some of the research that we've done at our research center at the university has been to examine how birth rates and abortion rates have changed in our state over time, and in particular as a result of some of the restrictions. So between 2010 and present, we have lost certain abortion clinic facilities, which have increased the driving distances to those facilities in a number of counties. And what our colleagues have shown is that in those counties that experienced the greatest increase in distance, right? So those counties that lost the most access, they had significantly increased birth rates, meaning clearly people weren't getting the abortion services they needed. And those increases were particularly notable among low-income Wisconsin women. And so we're already seeing that folks are having restricted access in our state in light of COVID, as well as these efforts to suggest that reproductive health services aren't essential. We may be facing even more challenges to access.
Is it also a big concern for clinics and for people who need these clinics that they're, sometimes their only option is to travel? And in a time when it's not advised to stay in a hotel, you know, the whole point is to stay in your community as much as you can. How does this impact further risks?
What I think is interesting about that is in Wisconsin, we have something called informed consent, which means that it is mandatory for the physician to explain the risks of an abortion, the procedure of an abortion, information that can be done through a conversation. It's nothing that needs to be in person. First of all, not all states have informed consent. However, some states that do have mandatory informed consent, Wisconsin's one of them, they do allow telehealth options. For example, Minnesota has mandatory informed consent. However, they will allow you to do that meeting over the phone. Michigan is another state. These are both border states of Wisconsin. So it's another reason why women may go to Minnesota or Wisconsin, because they can do these things over the phone. Michigan allows people to go on the Department of Health website and read the forms and the manuals there, and then they can print out the form and sign it and bring it into the clinic on the time of their procedure. Wisconsin doesn't allow those options. In Wisconsin, you have to be in person to have this informed consent visit. Then you have a mandatory 24-hour waiting period before the actual abortion procedure. That's assuming that there's even an appointment available the next day. So there's already these barriers. And right now in a global pandemic, to have women drive to clinics and leave their homes for a meeting that can easily be done on the phone or via the internet, and it's been shown that other states are doing that, is really unnecessary.
And does the informed consent also apply to abortion medication?
It does. Whether it's a surgical abortion or a medication abortion, informed consent is required, and it has to be in person.
If I may, I may make a small clarification there, and I know this is what Barbara meant. Any patient anywhere has to give informed consent before undergoing a procedure, right? So that's just a standard part of medical practice. What Barbara's talking about here is mandatory in-person counseling and consent, which can very easily be done over the phone, particularly in a situation like COVID. In states that don't have this mandatory 24-hour waiting period, people can provide that in-person consent and get their counseling the day that they receive an in-clinic abortion or medication abortion pills. But in Wisconsin, it's a required extra day and state mandated in-person counseling. And that's what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. So along those notes, where does this change need to come from in order to make telehealth services for Planned Parenthood achievable when it comes to this step of in-person consents? What's the call to action?
It comes down to legislators making an amendment to allow informed consent to be on the phone or the internet through a telehealth option, basically. So people need to call their legislators and demand that these changes be made. Other states are doing it. There's no reason that Wisconsin shouldn't do it. Ideally, these changes should be made indefinitely, but most certainly during a global pandemic.
I would agree with what Barbara said, there are many changes to the landscape of abortion care that we would like to make. But at a minimum, particularly right now in the age of COVID, we need to urge legislators in our state to make sure telemedicine is available for medication abortion services. This is consistent with best practices in clinical medicine and in our professional medical organizations, and it needs to be available to people here in our state as well. I would add that more globally, the people making the decisions about the ways in which abortion care is delivered in our state should be physicians, healthcare practitioners, and not politicians. So, as I mentioned, our mainstream medical professional organizations, including the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they all advocate for access to abortion, telemedicine for medication abortion, and those things should be absolutely true in our state as well. So we need folks to call and put pressure on their legislators to support telemedicine, particularly right now.
I can't help but think that, especially now, the pandemic is on top of our minds, but as rulings get overturned, as restrictions are more relaxed, the public's attention can easily go on to the next thing. So how do we continue to make access to Planned Parenthood clinics and to care and to telehealth beyond a pandemic at the top of people's minds?
It's a great question. One thing that I do think will keep this issue at the forefront is in June, the Supreme Court is hearing a case that reconsiders an abortion decision that was made in Texas in the Supreme Court case a few years ago. The results of this case are likely to have major ramifications for abortion legislation, whether it's an overturning of Roe or other sorts of restrictions. So I do think that that case will lead to more national attention to this issue, and I hope more attention in our state. In the meantime, we can't lose sight that reproductive health is a critical part of people's overall health during a pandemic and in day-to-day life. And in fact, there's more reason than ever to help people prevent and terminate the pregnancies they don't want to have in an era or in a moment of looming economic recession, drastic increases in unemployment rates, and other factors. So to me, continuing to emphasize that protecting people's health and well-being during COVID, which includes protecting people's abilities to live the lives they want to lead economically and in terms of employment, contraception and abortion are absolutely essential in order to support folks in those endeavors.
Dr. Jenny Higgins is a UW-Madison professor in gender and women's studies and obstetrics and gynecology. Barbara Alvarez is a PhD student at UW-Madison studying information access and abortion. After the break, we learn about what rights journalists have while covering protests. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As protests have swept America over racial justice, many are learning the hard way what their First Amendment rights entail. Like the freedom of assembly and freedom of speech, the free press has more than a few caveats too. Several high-profile incidents of journalists getting injured or arrested over the past few weeks have provided an insight into some of the caveats. So we wanted to see how the Supreme Court and Wisconsin state law treat the free press. Lake Effect's Julian Haida recently spoke with media law expert Eric Uglund, an associate professor at Marquette University's College of Communications.
The first question I have regards journalists' rights. We know that the Constitution protects a free press, but in the eyes of the law, whether it be here in Wisconsin or nationally, who is a journalist? What is the press?
Well, the press is essentially anybody who is serving a press function or a journalistic function. So all of us as citizens have a right to gather information and we have a right to report information. Some of us do that professionally and more systematically. But it's really a right that all individual citizens possess. Now, there are certain situations where a government official might want to give or might be willing to give more conventional journalists special access to a certain place, but they don't have to provide special access. So in that sense, all of us are sort of on an equal footing, whether we are average citizens, protesters, people working professionally as journalists, we all have the same sort of baseline set of rights.
So one of the reasons we asked you on the show today is because there have been, you know, at least a dozen, if not more, incidents of either journalists getting arrested by the police during these protests that we've seen in recent weeks, or injured by the police. There have been cases in Minneapolis and in other cities where journalists have presented themselves as journalists to the police, and the police have said, I don't care. So is there a flip side to that coin where journalism, while not interfered upon, also isn't protected?
Yeah, I mean, the number of incidents right now of journalists being targeted is really shocking. And this is not to diminish the fact that there are all kinds of other people who are out protesting, who are targeted, who are tear gassed, who are shot with rubber bullets. But this is a sort of a sidebar to that. It's another species of suppression that's going on, which is to isolate journalists and the press and subject them to a certain kind of punishment in order to achieve a slightly different objective, which is to essentially cut off dissemination of information about a protest or to essentially prevent witnessing by the broader community. So, to the extent that journalists are out there gathering information and conspicuously covering a protest as journalists, a police ought to give them the space to do that and not treat them as protesters. Certainly they shouldn't be separately targeted. And when they separately target journalists, that is absolutely a violation of those journalists' right to gather information. So there's a separate kind of First Amendment problem that's presented. Now, I should add too that that doesn't mean that journalists have any unique rights to be in certain places beyond those of the general public. So if police are enforcing a curfew or justifiably clearing a physical space, journalists can't just wave their, you know, press badge and say, you know, I'm exempt. They do have to comply with that. But if they are, targeted in any way, arrested, detained, shot at, for the purpose of intimidating them or cutting off their journalistic activity, their news gathering activity, then that's clearly a violation of the First Amendment.
So we talked a little bit about how journalists as a kind of a professional field don't have any special protections under the law, but I also understand that there are some local jurisdictions that extend protections regarding whether or not a journalist needs to speak when subpoenaed. I'm thinking of situations where journalists have had to protect their sources in recent years, especially with regards to their reporting on sexual abuse and, you know, protecting victims. So how does the law treat the kind of information that journalists have to disclose, either after they're arrested or in situations like being subpoenaed?
Yeah, so there's a couple situations there. I mean, one would be a situation where, let's say, a journalist is arrested or detained at the site of a protest and has his or her equipment or phone confiscated. That device cannot be searched without a warrant. Newsroom facilities cannot be searched, even with a warrant under certain circumstances because of a law passed by Congress. So there are certain protections like that that prevent news gathering artifacts and work products of journalists to be sort of immune from search, except under very rare circumstances. But those items can then be subpoenaed if a phone contains evidence relevant to a crime they could issue a subpoena and try to get the information that way. But at least then the journalist lawyers would have a chance to challenge the subpoena and so on. And it's not as invasive as a search. Then there's the other situation of just generally reporters' ability to protect their sources and work product against any kind of subpoena or a subpoena to testify, for example. And just about every jurisdiction in the country has some protection for journalists to protect their sources and to refuse to testify under certain circumstances. So that's known as the reporter's privilege. And so that sounds like a real special rights kind of characterization, right? It sounds like, well, that, you know, journalists, if they fit into this exalted category, you know, have the special sphere of rights. And in a sense, that's true. But the way that the courts have defined journalists more recently in that domain is to say that it's anyone who is gathering and disseminating newsworthy information where they had that intention at the start of the news gathering process. You know, it's not just some pretext after the fact. They went out, they left their house that day to work as a journalist, to gather information from sources. It doesn't matter if they work for CNN or the New York Times or they have their own blog. Their intention is to gather and disseminate newsworthy information, and that's the only criterion. So courts have been sort of leaning more toward this kind of egalitarian concept of who is a reporter for purposes of the reporter's privilege.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and with me is Eric Uglund. He's an associate professor at Marquette University's College of Communications, where he teaches media law. Now, something you mentioned earlier I think is very interesting, and that is the idea of gathering information in a public place. I think people might be familiar with some of the lawsuits surrounding paparazzi over the decades. What kind of rights do people have, journalists and otherwise, to record and gather information in public places?
All of us as citizens have a right to take photographs in public, to shoot video in public, to be in places where the public generally is entitled to go on public property. And so there are some rare exceptions to that where you might say invade somebody's privacy. And that would be a really unusual circumstance where they are in a position outside of their own home where they still have what the court calls a reasonable expectation of privacy. So generally when you leave your house, you surrender your interests in privacy. But, you know, if you're in a public restroom or you're in a locker room or you're in a hospital bed or something, you do still have some privacy interests in those places. But outside of that, the assumption is that people out in public can be monitored, they can be observed, they can be photographed, and they can be recorded. Now, the one exception with recording is you have to be cautious about capturing people's private conversations to which you are not a party. In the state of Wisconsin, we are a one-party state, which means under the wiretap law. So that means you and I could have a conversation. I could record the conversation without your knowledge, and I could even disseminate that conversation, and it would not violate the law. In other states, two-party states, both parties would have to consent to the recording.
How many states are one-party states?
I think it's a minority of states that are two-party states. The majority are one-party states like Wisconsin. But now when you're out in public shooting video with the audio function activated and you capture somebody having a conversation, including potentially, there's a caveat here, but including, let's say, a police officer talking to a suspect, the general rule is you better be cautious about recording that conversation if it's not clear that you're recording it and you're not a party to the conversation. Now, the caveat with that is that in the Seventh Circuit, the federal appellate court jurisdiction that Wisconsin is part of, the court said in 2012 that recording police officers, even their conversations, the audio conversations, is protected activity under the First Amendment. Police officers, in a sense, have a much more sort of diminished expectation of privacy when they are on the job.
That's interesting because I think we'd be led to believe that that's the opposite, given how frequently police officers have told journalists to turn off their cameras, to leave a space, and don't like it when the camera keeps rolling.
This is a fairly new trend in the law. So, you know, a few years ago, I could have understood some police officers not quite getting this, but this is such a such a strong trend in the law now for courts to recognize a constitutional right to record the police, that the number of violations I see of this, even before the George Floyd protests, was astonishing. I mean, just so many videos of police officers seizing phones, smashing phones, forcing somebody to delete video or delete photographs. So now, of course, if a police officer is engaged with a suspect and it's a kind of fraught situation, they can prevent you from physically interfering or sort of getting so close that you present a safety risk.
Which journalistic ethics generally provides anyway.
Right, yeah.
Now, I want to ask you an ethical question. We were talking earlier about how certain local jurisdictions, whether they be police departments, cities, do credential journalists, especially if they are from some traditionally defined publications, newspapers, radio stations, etc. And sometimes a lot of one's access depends on those credentials. I mean, even in the case of the White House Press Association and the White House itself being at odds over the last few years about access. So when access in some cases appears to depend on favorable coverage, does that put journalists in an awkward position? Does it compromise their ability to hold those institutions accountable?
Well, I mean, there's sort of an ethical question and a legal question there. I mean, the legal question is, or issue is, that the government does have the ability to exercise some discretion in giving press credentials to journalists where access as a practical matter has to be limited. You know, we can't have 4,000 journalists in the briefing room at the White House. So that's fine, but they have to exercise that authority or discretion in a content neutral way. They can't just allow Fox and, you know, Breitbart and America One or whatever it is into the White House press room and not CNN and the New York Times and so on. So it has to be ideologically neutral. Otherwise, they could be accused of exercising their government authority in a way to you know, block certain messages or ideologies. The ethical question is a tricky one too. I mean, it's more of an ethical issue on the part of the person who makes the judgment in the government about who gets these credentials. And I think it's something that journalists have to essentially fight for. It does present a little bit of a challenge for some mainstream journalists, you know, who might see an organization that's, you know, a little more peripheral, maybe not so professional. And, you know, their inclination might be to say, well, these people aren't really doing the good work of objective journalism. But it does become very, very much a slippery slope.
Something you raise is somewhat interesting, and that is like a political attitude or an ideological attitude. Now, at a time when journalists are being called enemies of the people, I mean, we've heard this coming from all sorts of places, not only the White House, and where ideological stances are prescribed to different media outlets in a apparently willy-nilly way, I'm wondering, does that kind of politically empower police departments who are engaging with journalists to act in a manner that might be more forceful than at a time when journalism as a field was better respected in this country?
I think there's no doubt. And this presents two problems. One is aggressive behavior by law enforcement officials and government officials more generally. I think the rhetoric from the White House over the last several years has emboldened those who see the press as the enemy or who are predisposed to kind of have those attitudes to be more aggressive. A lot of reporters have been dealing with some physical abuse but certainly regular verbal abuse. And a lot of that's coming from the right, but there are some on the left as well who feel like the press is, you know, an institutional driver of the status quo and so on. And but whatever direction it's coming from, I think a lot of journalists would say that they absolutely feel like they are much more the target these days than they were in the past.
And therefore it makes it difficult to challenge those groups of people harassing journalists.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Professor Uglund, and sharing your experience and knowledge on media law.
Happy to do it.
Eric Uglund is an associate professor at Marquette University's College of Communications, where he teaches media law. He spoke with LakeFX's Julian Haida. Some of the issues addressed in the interview, especially regarding recording without consent, are sure to be raised by the State House after Governor Evers admitted to recording private phone calls with Republican leaders. Keep up to date on that story and more at WUWM.com. Coming up, we hear from this season's winner of RuPaul's Drag Race, Milwaukee native Jada Essence Hall. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Since the pandemic began, many of us have been glued to our couches binge-watching TV. And for fans of RuPaul's Drag Race, it's been a good time to be stuck at home. The series, which features a cast of drag queens competing for the title of America's Next Drag Superstar, premiered its 12th season as shutdowns began to sweep through American cities. While the majority of the season was filmed long before stay-at-home orders were in place, the finale was a bit different. The top three contestants were each tasked with filming their last performance in their homes. For Milwaukee native Jada Essence Hall, that meant performing a full dance number in her West Dallas living room. But it all paid off. Hall, also known as Jared Johnson, was crowned the winner in a virtual ceremony. Lake Effect's Joy Power spoke with Hall about the competition and Milwaukee's drag culture.
So what was it like sitting in your apartment in West Dallas, Wisconsin, winning this really career-defining competition?
First, it was so interesting because we had to sit and watch it live with just me and the other two girls from the show. So we had no idea what would happen. Our reaction was going to be recorded. So I was like, oh my God, hopefully this is good for me, because you never know, like, if disappointment will come and what your face will look like. But it was amazing. My favorite part of all of it was winning, like, the biggest moment in my career, and then just clicking the button to log off the Zoom chat and then just sitting in my house. But it was really, it's just so surreal to like dream of something this big to happen in your life, and then it actually really, really will happen. That's the craziest part.
You know, this was a crazy season in general. Although most of it was filmed before the pandemic, the last challenge, the finale, that was all done really virtually. What was that experience like? I mean, coordinating that must have been really difficult.
I mean, I give all the props to everyone over at World of Wonder. They figured out a very creative way to make everything happen, and I think they did a really great job doing so, but we also had to do our part. And I don't consider myself the most like creative production wise person, because I've never had to do production, do productions in that kind of way before. But we had boxes of things that I've never seen in my life, tripods and gimbals and like all of these weird things. But it was so interesting to like put it all together. And when I watched it back and like be really proud of like, I kind of did that, you know, like, I put that together. I helped. I did my part. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not a production person before. But to see like, okay, I produced it. I made sure that the looks were really cute. They gave a lot of good direction, but I did a little bit of what I could do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it all came out really well. I was impressed by your ability and the other two competitors, their ability to really pull this off.
Yeah, and like I said about the creativity, obviously you can says how creative my sisters were. Like Crystal and Gigi for our at-home lip sync, they turned it and like got so creative with like the production and like the sets that they had to do. And especially like Gigi, because she loves references, and for her to like turn that the aha moment and make it so like nostalgic. And then for Crystal to do something which was so crazy that I have never ever seen in my life. And probably will never see again, especially like the regurgitating bird. But it was so unique to her. And even what I did myself was so creative, but it just showed you the level of creativity and uniqueness of the girls that made it in the top on the show.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the two other queens who were in the top three, Crystal Method and Gigi Good. Interestingly, all of the queens who were in the top three have some kind of connection to the Midwest.
Yes.
Crystal Method from Missouri, Gigi Good originally from Illinois. There does seem to be something special and unusual about the queens that come out of the Midwest. What is it about it that helped shape at least you as a drag performer?
You know, I think the Midwest has a lot of heart. And it doesn't matter what you do in drag, I think that warmth from the Midwest always just rubs off to you. Like sometimes I'll go places and I like when everything was fine and I'm like working and everyone's like, oh, well, you don't have to keep saying sorry or saying thank you. I'm like, that's just what we do. Like, it doesn't matter how talented you are, if you've made it that far, we still like have so much heart. And I think that with the show, the heart is really important, especially this season. The heart was so important for everyone to be locked down at home. And we needed to just basically just have like something positive happening right now. And thank God there were a good amount of girls from the Midwest and had a lot of heart to give.
Yeah, making those connections, I think, especially during this pandemic, as you say, has been very important. You know, looking kind of pre-pandemic to the Milwaukee area, you're actually one of a few different queens who've competed from Milwaukee, including Trixie Mattel, who I believe you know.
Yeah.
For people who might not be familiar with it, how would you describe Milwaukee's drag scene just in general?
Milwaukee's drag scene is so eclectic. I think before it was very much like you had better be beautiful and you had better know how to dance. And I think one of the things I'm just being honest, I think seeing the success that Trixie had opened up the door for a lot of us here. I mean, some people were already starting to like be like, you know what, I'm going to define drag in my own way and what works best for me. Now, when you see it within the city, everybody is so many people are so different from each other. And then also not only just different from each other, but they have so many varied styles within who they are too. Like even for myself on the show, like you saw, like I can be funny. I can dance when needed. I cannot sing, but I can be pretty and have nice things and know how to sew and be creative. And every girl in the city can do those same things. And especially works at that because we didn't really have too many resources to reach out and like let's say, oh, I think I want to do this beautiful look. We've had to learn how to teach ourselves how to make those things and do those kind of things. So every queen here is just so unique in the fact that they bring something different from multiple angles just within themselves, but then also at the same time, they are such fighters and so strong and so creative and unique.
Yeah, and I mean, all of that is so important. I think, especially right now, we're in the middle of this pandemic. As you mentioned, this past season, a lot of people were viewing it from their couches where they've been spending quite a lot of time.
Yeah. Couch floor is all in the back.
What has it been like just working as a drag queen during this pandemic, as the show, you know, is really showing off so much of your talent? What has that experience been like for you?
I think it's been really unique in the fact that just anything that I do in my life, I always try to go in with like a blank slate. Like I don't want to assume what will happen, because then if you assume and stuff, that's how you get let down. But as this started to happen, I was like, okay, well, this is starting to seem like what will happen is that we will be in our homes during this time. And I didn't really want to do too much work, like too many like digital shows and that kind of thing, because I had a feeling that if things did not go the way we were expecting, we would have to do the finale digitally. And I didn't want to give people too much And then when they saw the digital, the finale, they were like, oh, well, maybe it's not that exciting because we already saw her doing all of this. But it's just so unique in the fact that what I didn't think that I would be really good at doing drag from home or interacting with like the people who support us on the show from home. And it turns out I can actually really make connections with people over social media and that kind of thing. And so it just makes me proud to like know that like I say all the time, drag queens are fighters and we usually are used to working in sometimes in terrible predicaments and situations, but we always turn it and make a way. And this pandemic has been no different.
Yeah. You know, under normal circumstances, you would probably be performing around town a bit, but of course, everything has been closed here. We're now actually starting to see some restaurants and bars open up, at least here in Milwaukee. I'm not positive about West Dallas yet. Actually, did you hear that Dick's opened?
I did not know, but that'll be interesting. I think Dick's is one of my favorite spots in the city too. So I'm excited. Hopefully for it to open back up and people to like slowly start to see each other. I know a lot of people have been missing a lot of social interaction, but I just want people to make sure that they are staying safe, as safe as possible, and like coming out prepared, mask and all that stuff, so that just in case anything, nobody gets sick or any of that stuff.
Yeah, there's been a lot of confusion. Even when the order came down, a lot of restaurants and bar owners, you know, were saying they didn't have enough notice. They didn't feel like they had enough information to actually reopen.
Yeah. And I think it's like a weird space because some of the bars haven't been able to make money. And so it's like, do we have the resources to open, especially if we've not been, all of it's like very blurred lines, almost like West Dallas, South Milwaukee, all of this area is very blurred lines. It's like hard to tell what to do, but I'm like, but what we can do, okay, is know our part and make sure that we come out sanitized and clean and ready to go.
Oh yeah. Yeah, West Dallas, you guys have different rules over there, but it's also like West Dallas, Tosa, they're both suburbs that are so interconnected with the city that it feels like what the city does is ultimately what ends up happening in those nearby suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Literally, like you drive through those suburbs and not even realize you went through them. But like all the communities in Milwaukee, that's one of the things I tell people all the time. I'm like, Milwaukee has so many different communities. And it's literally like you can go, like, I don't think people realize that it's like almost like Chicago. You know, you go to like a certain neighborhood and you're like, oh my God, this is completely different. And that's so much like Milwaukee, the same way like you out in Bayview and West Dallas, so different from each other, or like the East Side, everything is so different from each other.
Well, and of course, you know this, but Milwaukee is such, it's considered the most segregated city in America, which in part explains why different neighborhoods are so different.
Yeah. Like, I tell people that a lot, too. I'm like, that's one of the things also about the city is, like, it's weird that it's so segregated. But I think that's part of, like, the past, and hopefully we can get around that. Because, like, you think about it, like, you go and you can literally tell, like, where the Black community is really separated, and the Latino community. And that's one of the things I really don't like about the city. But also at the same time, I'm just hoping that we can get, like I said, we can get around that and fix that kind of issue, because these are things that like that were happening in the city before we were even, before I was even thought of and born. And so many of us in that segregation, like with redlining in the neighborhoods and stuff like that. So I'm hoping that like if the banks and like all the different people in the city can like get together and we can figure this out, because I think we all deserve to be able to live in amazing neighborhoods. And we all deserve to go to amazing schools, even if they are outside of our neighborhood. Just some of those things, because that's plaguing, like constantly plaguing our, like, especially like the Black community and like the Latino community, being so separated. We can talk, like, as Black people talk about the issue that we have in our community and how we want change to happen as much as we want to until we turn blue in the face. But until we have like allies who stand up and like, you know what, we are also sick of this and this is not fair. Until we have people who can also ultimately help us make that change, things won't change. And like we're seeing that right now, like with what's going on in the world right now, like we have been talking about like police brutality for years, and not much has happened, but now also allies are like, okay, this is getting a little tired and we are a little bit fed. Like, this is ridiculous. And now that they're using the voice, change is starting to progress even further and even faster.
Yeah. So, you know, to turn back a bit to Drag Race and your future, I think all throughout the season, you're known for your makeup work, of course, your style, but you're also, as you mentioned, a very engaging performer. We can see that in your final lip sync from your home. You can really dance.
Thank you.
What do you see as your future in drag? What do you want to do?
You know what? I think there are things that I've always wanted to do. Like, I love making clothes and designing, so I hopefully I do more design work. Also, I'm hoping that maybe I could be like do some modeling, because I know like they're usually from the show, people like to assume a specific type, like as far as like for fashion, to do fashion work after the show. But I always, and if you ever join me on my late night lives, you will know I love top model. I love like modeling, and we talk about that a lot. But that was like something I've always wanted to do. And sometimes people have told me like, well, you'll probably not be able to wear a body, or designers might not want to work with a black girl from the show, and that kind of stuff. And I was like, well, hopefully I can be the girl that makes a change in that. But then I also want to do makeup stuff, hopefully like be able to create a line with makeup. And I say hopefully a lot because it's weird, because I think that things are a possibility for me, but I just don't want to like psych myself up too much for it and be disappointed. But I do see myself doing a lot of things like fashion and modeling and makeup, some of the things that I've always loved and hopefully I can have a chance to do, which I feel like is really important. Like I said before, I like to leave a blank slate. I don't want to like all fill up the plate with too many ideas, because what my drag can become from this will definitely change. And I want to leave room for that change. And if it moves in another direction and something else happens from it, and I want it to organically move that way and just happen in that kind of way, and just like, see, like, well, you know what? This is something I never thought I would do, but turns out I love doing this, like maybe making a music video, but it will take a lot of singing classes, but maybe some stuff like that, like music or videos and just stuff that I've never imagined for myself. Those things can be a possibility.
Yeah. Well, Jada, Jared, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. Means a lot. And I'm so glad that like I can literally represent my city and be on our radio here in Milwaukee, which is again something that I did not think I would be doing, but now it's happening. So it's incredible.
Thanks.
Milwaukee native Jada Essence Hall is the reigning queen of RuPaul's Drag Race, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.